Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to this special Veterans Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes. It is so heartening to see all the expressions of gratitude across the country for our men and women in uniform, and to see how that sentiment can be found in just about every corner of our culture, including the tip-off of college basketball season, and the University of Arizona wearing USS Arizona-themed jerseys for its opener against Michigan State in Honolulu. Honolulu is where global attention will be focused on December 7th for the 75th anniversary of a Sunday morning that changed the world. Again, I want to remind you, you can find links to Pearl Harbor-related episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. We've talked to people who were all over the island of Oahu that day, from Battleship Row to Hickam, Wheeler, Schofield Barracks, you name it. But one of the more interesting perspectives came from a man who would become a record-breaking pilot. He's 98 years old now, and he's still flying model airplanes competitively in Southern California. But on December 7th, 1941, he was approaching Honolulu after a long flight from Northern California. When he kissed his wife Betty Jo goodbye the night before, Robert Thacker had no idea what he'd be getting into.
We had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three-star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, oh, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian, and I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower, no answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, blah, blah, blah. No one said, come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So, I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, a tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, bang, 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 all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire. And anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I chopped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me. They shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial airdrop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line. And if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
I can't imagine the amount of things that go through your mind in a situation like that. When you know that your friends are dying, you don't know what's going to happen to you. How did you respond to the chaos?
Everything went out of those barracks. Everything went out of those hangars. There were motorcycles. There were people. There were engines. Everything was on fire. They wiped out that. They did a beautiful job with it. And 13 biddies, I think they were, at about 8,000. And they didn't miss. They really wiped out that flight line. And where are you going to go? What are you going to do? How can you help? How can you protect? First thing you do is protect your crew, which we left that out. And a little sort of side story. I took the crew down to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel on Wednesday for lunch. It was all free. The Japs were going to take the islands. There's no question about it. We had no foxholes. We had no nothing. It's an unbelievable story. And the Japanese did such a perfect operation. Mass, surprise, all of the great elements of war, and they did it beautifully. There's no question about that. They sank every boat in that harbor. There were 3 feet of bunker fuel on fire in Pearl Harbor. They sank every boat in the harbor. They sank the floating dock, and they sank the boat in the floating dock. Quite an operation.
And I know, as someone with the military background that you have, you can appreciate the success of their operation, but I'm sure emotionally for you, being an American, wearing that uniform, and seeing that devastation had to have some kind of impact on you. What did it do to you in terms of your focus and desire to do anything?
You asked me where I grew up, and I said I grew up in the Air Force. That grew you up real quick. Real quick. But I think my attitude is just a little bit different, because the military was going to be my career. I made a judgment at that time. And the military is like any other, it's like General Motors or any other big corporation. And it was my job. It was my job. And I was lucky to survive.
And he'd go on to serve 31 years in the Air Force before retiring as a colonel. So many things he was fortunate to survive, but especially that morning of December 7th. And as he described ending up at Hickam Field that day, it made me think of the folks we've heard from on Hometown Heroes who were at that Army Air Corps base that morning. Leon Webster had grown up in Oklahoma and Arkansas, volunteered to serve in 1939, and had gotten to Hickam Field before the barracks were even up, when it was just a tent city. Here's how he remembered December 7th, 1941.
I was adjacent to our barracks wing at Hickam Field, which was a new constructed barracks there. And I'd looked up from the street adjacent to my wing, and a Japanese fighter pilot was diving directly at me, standing in the street. And I could see the old concrete street ripping up in front of me before I dove to the right, as my friend Don Thompson says, get the hell out of the street, and just missed being killed for the first time in my life, thank God.
The first time, and when you say the first, it kind of sounds like it might not be the last. How close would you say those strafing bullets from that Japanese plane came to you?
It was close enough so that I now can close my eyes. The pilot was diving on the street I was standing in, adjacent to my barracks wing at Hickam Field. It's a wing, by the way, that you can still go to and place your fingers and hands into some large bomb-shredded parts that were cut out of the wing when they attack us on December 7th.
So this strafing is ripping up the street in front of you, and you could feel the concrete on your neck?
I absolutely could, yet. I can just close my eyes and remember that day, the only day that I knew for a fact that I was trying to be killed. I have never had an experience like it, and of course, being that type of experience is one that I'll never forget. I can almost feel the concrete chips as they hit the left cheek of my face as he cut up the street, diving with his machine guns going.
And I've talked to a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors, and most of them expressed that confusion initially, thinking that this was some kind of maneuver, that these were American airplanes. Sounds like you didn't have much doubt in your mind.
Not at that time, but earlier we all thought it was a mock attack by the Navy or from Wheeler Field, which was a fighter base, and because we had had mock attacks from those places previously, and that was our first thought. But after the bullets started hitting nearby, we realized it was the real thing. And then we looked up and could see the large red circle on the bottoms of the wings of the attacking aircraft. And then we were sure it was Japanese planes.
So you're ducking for cover from this plane. And then I imagine you had to be experiencing some kind of fear, concern, doubt, anxiety. How would you describe what happened after that and what you were able to do?
I was able to dive to my right from the street over to a building that was built about for the reason they were building, making those temporary buildings for supply that was directly across the street from the wing of my barracks, about 2 feet off the ground because of the humidity in Hawaii. And I got back under that where a friend of mine, Don Thompson, was already there and yelling for me to get the hell out of the street.
Mm-hmm. So you guys took cover in that little 2-foot separation from the ground to the base of these buildings?
That's right. That's correct. And those buildings were all built about 2 feet off the ground due to the humidity in those days in Hawaii.
How long would you say that you stayed huddled under there?
There was 2 attacks, and we got out after the first attack just momentarily, and due to the commotion and the people yelling, they're coming back, we ran back and got under the same building we were under previously, which saved us, and it was the most natural place to go when the second attack occurred.
When you were in a situation like that, really not in control, just praying that nothing hits that building that's going to blow it up or goes through it and gets you, what do you do? Are you clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? Are you talking to each other? What are you doing?
As a matter of fact, I've thought about the moments that attack happened, and I can't describe it because I know I was in total shock. I'd never been in such a situation. And what I did was just something you do automatically, and it never gave much thought to it. It was something you just do.
What did you see when it was finally safe to crawl out from under there?
Actually, we saw a lot of guys that had been hit by the strafing aircraft and was lying, and someone confiscated an old truck there on the base at Hickam Field. And my friend of mine, Donald Thompson, and I was helping pick up people that were wounded and was dead and putting them in groups and helping load them onto this truck to be taken up to Fort Shafter, which was our headquarters building. And then later they wound up in the cemetery up there in the old vacant volcano.
The Punch Bowl.
Punch Bowl Cemetery, yes.
And I have to guess, now I know that you lost your father when you were just 8 years old, and dealing with that kind of tragedy is tough, but I have to imagine you had never witnessed anything like these wounded men and dead bodies that you were trying to pack up and get out of there.
Never before in my imagination, and actually never since. It's the most frightening day I can think of that happened to me in my lifetime. But on the other hand, it's the most thankful day that I survived it, because all around me were friends of mine, and actually in my one squadron at Hickam Field at the time, where there were many, many different squadrons, we lost 8 personal friends of mine from my one squadron.
How hard was that? Did you look at them and say, that could have been me? How did you deal with that?
I think I was in such shock, I don't believe I could describe that to you, although I'd like to. You just can't believe what's happened when those things happen and you see dead bodies lying all around outside the barracks in those days, and you help load them onto trucks to be carried away. You're in such shock that it'd be hard to describe.
When did you realize, you've gotten this personal glimpse of it, you've seen your friends killed, but when did you grasp the entire scope of what had happened there and the significance of the lives lost and the blow that Japan had landed on America that day?
It wasn't soon. It actually happened at least a day later, after we spent most of the night not sleeping at all, and after we'd visited certain places on the base and helped load people that were wounded and dead, and went down to our barracks to see many of our aircraft destroyed and the fires that were still burning down at the flight line in those days, and just the shock of it all. I don't think the first night after the raid I slept at all.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, Battleship Row, where the most damage was done, and the story of a man who survived 34 hours trapped in his capsized battleship, only to learn that his brother did not make it out alive. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.